7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman, and also chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimers. Gastenheimer, not plural. Are you ladies enjoying our cooled off weather a little bit?
A little bit.
Great. Nice to be here with you.
Hello, Linda.
Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Also with us, we visit with food historian and author Abigail Carroll. She's written Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal, and she joins us now from Vermont Public Radio. Hi, Abigail.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here.
How are things in Vermont weather-wise?
Oh, they're not quite white yet unless you live in the mountains, but we've had a few dustings.
Hmm. Oh, sounds very nice.
That sounds kind of good, doesn't it?
So getting to your book, you found that the shape of our meals reflects the shape of our society. Would you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, our eating has changed over time, and I think that we're not just what we eat, as the famous saying goes, but we're also how we eat. And just as our society has changed, so have our meals. As we've gone through an industrial revolution, our eating was really turned on its head. And as we, you know, entered a century, the 20th century, and now the 21st century, when we're working more than any other industrialized Western nation, you know, our eating habits, and especially the shape in which we eat, our meals are reflecting that and are being changed to accommodate that.
Well, you know, Three Squares and all, I was surprised when I read your book, Abigail, that we've only been having, a big dinner at night for 150 years, is that right?
That's right. It used to be the midday meal, and that was what suited agrarian society, when people would wake up at 5 in the morning, you know, and they would start their chores very, very early and have breakfast, say, at 7. And then, you know, by 11, 12, they were ready for a really substantial hot meal. And it also made sense to do the cooking in the morning, you know, before there was artificial light. And it wouldn't make sense to be cooking, you know, later in the day and eating, especially in the winter when it would get dark so early, and you'd be wasting your very precious resources of fuel, you know, your candles and your oil lamps, for an evening dinner. And so, but that changed in the 1800s, changed with the Industrial Revolution.
So people were away from their homes, so they couldn't come home for lunch.
That's right.
Well, you know, I thought it was very interesting because, you know, I did live in Paris for a while, and their main meal was still at noon. And this was not that long ago. And the children had their main meal at school, and they just had a snack at night. So,
isn't that really, by and large, isn't that a healthier way of eating, really?
I'm not the one to ask that. I'm not a nutritionist.
Linda, isn't that a healthier way?
Who knows what's healthy or not healthy? Is it a healthier way of eating if you're going to have, you know, a fat-laden, you know, hamburger, cheese, and I won't name certain vendors of that, with a bunch of French fries, and you're having that at noon or night? What difference does it make when you have it if it's not good for you?
Right. I just thought maybe if you could burn off more during the day, you know, that if you had a more substantial meal during the day and less at night, that was probably a healthier way to go.
So, Abigail, historically, going back eons, did people just hunt, gather, and then eat when they were hungry?
Well, you know, my book really starts in the 1600s, but when the colonists were, you know, first settling North America and encountering the Native Americans, they were surprised and rather appalled by the fact that the Native Americans didn't seem to observe regular meals, that they tended to graze. They did have some structure to their eating, but the structure was pretty minimal compared to colonial tradition, and so the colonists just saw it as no structure whatsoever. And for them, that was evidence that these people were uncivilized. And I think it was very important to the Europeans to have regularity when it came to eating and to control their eating. But I would say that their eating in the, you know, in the 1600s, early 1700s, wasn't nearly as civilized as, you know, they would like for people to have thought it to have been. It was pretty rustic. It was pretty haphazard.
Interesting talking about table manners. Tell us a little bit about what their table manners were then.
And their utensils.
They didn't have much.
Their
in
lack
the beginning.
Of.
Yeah, no, when it came to utensils, they, you know, they might have a knife, which they tended to, you know, have as a personal item. So if they went and ate at somebody else's house, they would bring their knife with them and use that.
Maybe they needed it for protection or whatever.
Who knows? Forks don't show up, you know, until the 1700s at all. You know, they're an Italian invention.
I was going to say, didn't Catherine de' Medici bring it to the French court?
I'm not sure about the European history of it, but yeah, and then people were using bread for spoons, but I mean, they were using their hands, and they were eating, you know, a lot of one pot kind of, you know, dishes, and they didn't necessarily talk a lot at meals. It just was not a place where you put on your best manners, like it you know, became that in the Victorian era. In fact, manners became extremely
important. Why do you think that happened in Victoria times, that manners became important?
I think it became important because people were no longer living in small towns where they knew people face to face, and they were living in cities, and that was a very anonymous experience. And this was the time with the Industrial Revolution when people were having a little bit more prosperity, and so there's the emergence of the middle class, and for the middle class, it's very important to be seen as middle class, and they need a way of expressing their class status and a way of recognizing whether or not other people were the same class as them. And so manners became a way of reading one's class.
When did those with, like the gentry, the landed gentry, how did their eating differ from that of the working class during colonial times?
Well, you know what's interesting is when people ate said a lot about their class status. And so while the, you know, average person in the pre-industrial era was eating a big hot dinner in the middle of the day, it was pretty early. It was often noon, but more typically 11, and in some cases even 10. But the, you know, the landed gentry were able to sleep in a little bit more, and they didn't, you know, perhaps work as hard. Not that they didn't exert themselves physically at all, but that they weren't sort of doing the more arduous farm labor. And so they would have their main meal at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And so that said something about them.
And made by servants, probably.
Yeah, for sure.
So when did we go from this British-inspired one-pot meal to the multi-course meal?
Well, that also happens with the rise of the middle class and industrialization and the shift of dinner to the evening. And, you know, people, as I mentioned, were looking for ways to express their new middle class status and their social mobility. And so manners was very important, but the other big thing is the kind of foods that they ate. And so they were beginning to eat French-inspired meals. So some of the foods they were eating were French-inspired, but more importantly, they were dividing their meal into a sequence. And so it started with an appetizer and it ended with dessert. And we can thank the French for those traditions of, you know, soup to begin a meal and a sweet dessert to finish it. And the salad typically followed the entree. And people did have 3 and 4 course meals in middle class homes. And one of the reasons they could do that now is because it was typical for the middle class to own servants, or not to own, but to have servants at this time.
So what happened then when servants started to become not available?
Well, something had to happen, you know, to the meal, because they just simply could not keep up.
Well, what period are we talking about? Let's get that straight a little bit.
So the sort of French-inspired course divided meal would have been in the 1800s. For the middle class, the second half of the 1800s. And then the servant problem, as people called it, begins in that period, in the second part of the 1800s, toward the end of the 1800s. And servants become less available, less affordable. And one of the reasons is because jobs are opening up for women in factories, and eventually some desk jobs are working, you know, are opening up for women. And they would rather those than, you know, scrubbing floors.
Right.
So, yeah. And so, but what happens then if you're the homemaker and you're used to relying on a servant to cook your meals for your family? Well, suddenly something has to happen. And the home economics movement sort of emerges out of this problem. And their solution is to train servants and make servitude sort of more professional, standardized, etc. But the problem is that servants don't sign up for the classes that they're offering. And the home economics movement ends up kind of training the homemaker to go back into the kitchen, but to do so in a way that is not drudgery, but to sort of reinvent cooking as professional. And so domestic science is sort of seen as a science and as a profession.
We're speaking with Abigail Carroll. She's an author and food historian, and her latest book is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. On today's Topical Currents, a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, a special edition. Bonnie Berman along with Linda Gastenheimer. Fred Tasker will be joining us a little later in the program. And we're visiting with food historian author Abigail Carroll. And she's the author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email also, that's radio@WLRN.org. Abigail Carroll, when did dinner become supper and supper become dinner and all that going back and forth?
Well, it was kind of a confusing time for a while because people didn't know, you know, when to eat what meal, because, you know, when things change, they don't change all at the same time. It's a process, and they change at different paces depending on sort of where you are. And so for people in the city, they were, you know, shifting dinner to the evening, and it became more of a family time and a special time. But if you were still in the country, you were still eating dinner in the middle of the day. And so, you know, and some people still hold to that tradition today. And so it's never been a kind of clean shift. Same thing when dinner shifts to the evening, people don't know, you know, whether to, you know, have this new thing called lunch or, you know, whether they should have two dinners, like a dinner in the middle of the day and a dinner in the evening. You know, newspapers would talk about how on a single street in a city, people, you know, one household might be having dinner in the middle of the day and another might be having it in the evening. And so if you want to call on your neighbors, you better, you know, keep in mind what kind of people are there, the people who are eating dinner, you know, in the middle of the day or in the evening. And so there's this couple decades in the late 1800s when it's a little confusing.
In today's vernacular, I can see people saying, I'm going home for supper, but you wouldn't say we're going out to supper, we're going out to dinner.
Mm. Dinner's always been more formal, and I think supper's always been seen as more informal. And, you know, the colonial supper really was very informal. It was kind of snack-like. People, you know, had leftovers from the, you know, earlier dinner in the middle of the day, or they had, you know, some pie, some cheese, a piece of bread. There's this collation of kind of snack-like foods, and so it was very informal. So yeah, I think supper's always been thought of as a bit more informal.
So moving into the 20th century and all, and the wars, I mean, World War One, I mean, that must have had a big change on our eating habits. What happened with that?
Well, you know, you asked about what happened with the servants, and this is kind of a continuation of that. You know, when servants were no longer available, people had to revise, you know, dinner. And it helped in the 20th century that there were a lot of other impetuses to revise dinner. There were two world wars. Both of them required a lot of thrift.
I'm thinking in terms of that so many men were gone. Women had to were out working more so than they had ever done. So how did food get on the table?
You know, it's interesting that, you know, the cooperative housekeeping movement was kind of fizzling out at that time. But it was still, you know, this was a time when people were being creative. And, you know, the cooperative housekeeping movement was one way in which they were creative.
Let's stop. What do you mean by the cooperative housekeeping movement?
What was that? This was an alternative to sort of the woman going back into the kitchen and doing the job of her servants. What families did who were interested in an alternative was to create a kind of club, pay their dues, rent a space, hire a cook and come together in the evening and have a meal that was prepared for them. Or the, you know, women of these households would take turns preparing meals. And now, another alternative was that they would have a communal kitchen and that they would prepare the dinners for this set of families and that they would be delivered. And during World War One, when a lot of women were
working.
I mean, not for all the women. This was definitely, you know, a smaller movement, although it would have been a household idea. People knew about it. That was one way that they got by.
When did, you said they didn't converse in colonial times. When did people start making a dinner a time to talk and converse? And
what, did they just grunt before?
And what was the role of children also?
Oh, right.
To
well,
be seen
certainly
and not
people
heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly people talked during the colonial era, but you know, a lot of travelers, you know, wrote in their diaries how surprised they were at how quickly Americans ate and how silently. And you know, I just think that that was really seen as a time of refueling, and people were often working together as a family unit, like if they were on a farm, you know, or if they owned a business and they were working together. And so dinner was not a time when they needed to catch up because there wasn't a lot to catch up on. But during the Industrial Revolution and the Victorian era, when people suddenly were going in different directions during the day and the gender spheres are becoming a little bit more demarcated, you know, children are going to school now more regularly as well. And so they come back home in the evening and dinner becomes a very important time to bond as a family and to remember who you are as a family. And so that's when conversation really becomes important. And it also becomes important because during this era, the Victorian era, the formal dinner party comes into being and becomes very socially important. If you were really middle class, then you would know, you would be invited to and you would host these formal dinner parties and you would know how to hold your own at one, including how to converse properly. And the etiquette books of this time are just filled with, you know, what not to say, because there's all sorts of liabilities. I mean, it was like a minefield. If you went to a formal dinner party, there was all sorts of, you know, mistakes you could make. And if you made those mistakes, then perhaps, you know, you would be seen as not really being middle class, but just sort of playing at middle class.
Like what kind of mistakes? Can you give us some examples?
Well, speaking of conversation, you could say the wrong word. There was all sorts of vulgarities, and we wouldn't consider them vulgarities today, but any reference to the body, such as stomach, at the dinner table would be seen as, you know, improper. Using the knife and fork improperly. In the colonial era before the fork, people were using their knives like a fork to sort of bring the food to their mouths after they
especially
cooked
the food. Especially with peas,
right? Yeah. And so, you know, once the fork came along, you didn't have to do that. But, you know, for the sort of more old-fashioned or the people who weren't, you know, up on the times, they might still use the knife in the old-fashioned way. And that's something that you could look for to tell if somebody, you know, was really middle class
or not.
Well,
where did this feeling about the fork, where the English eat the food on the back of the fork? The Americans, there's always this conversation that the Americans cut their meat, switch the fork to another hand, and then put it in their mouth, where the English just mush everything on the back of the fork in one movement. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, I'm sorry to say that I don't know the origins of the particular sort of continental American discrepancies there, but there were very particular ways about how to use silverware in the United States, not just in Europe. And oh, I'm thinking of the spoon. Like, it was, you know, important to use the spoon in a certain way, you know, to sort of ladle the soup to your mouth and not sort of dump the soup in your mouth, this kind of thing as well.
This is a real shift in gears, Abigail, but we were running a promo that said that you would tell us why popcorn is so associated with the movies, even though it makes
sure
a big mess to clean up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, snack food is just a fun story. And, you know, originally, the first snack foods, peanuts and popcorn and whatnot, were associated with public entertainment, fairs, political rallies, theaters, and especially sports, ballparks and whatnot. And so, you know, when movie theaters, let's see, I should start by saying peanuts, you know, were so popular at vaudeville theaters, and especially among the, you know, more working class crowd, that the cheap upper balconies were called peanut galleries because of all of the peanut shells that would be on the floor.
Oh, that's
so there's
where
an
that
association
comes, huh?
here with, you know, with snacking and entertainment and in particular theaters. Well, with the, you know, movie theater, actually, popcorn did not enter it for a while because it was seen as, you know, messy. And people looked down on snacking as lower class. And these movie theaters, you know, they people didn't want them to think of their movie theater as like a peanut gallery, you know, that they were just more sophisticated than that. And you know, people were starting to sell popcorn on the street because of steam poppers that were invented in the 1880s. And these steam poppers started selling outside of movie theaters, and people began showing up early to the movie so that they could, you know, snack or go out to eat before the movie. And eventually they were buying popcorn and bringing it into the theater. And still the theater owners were, you know, were not excited about that because, again, they saw it as a liability. You know, it was just going to be a mess to clean up, and it was also kind of lower class. But eventually they saw that it was so profitable, so they started renting space in the theater lobby to these popcorn vendors. But it wasn't until, you know, they saw how lucrative the popcorn business was that they started selling the popcorn themselves, and then eventually probably making more money on that than the entertainment.
And they still are.
Yeah.
So tell us about Cracker Jacks. I thought that was kind of neat, how they were more hygienic and more sanitary.
Sure, sure. So Cracker Jacks are invented by two German brothers in Chicago, was in Chicago around the time of the Great Fire. And they were experimenting with popcorn and molasses and peanuts and came up with Cracker Jacks or Cracker Jack. They were the first to basically package snack food and sell it. And so snack food had been considered something you would buy on the street or buy at a fair from a vendor. And there were all sorts of liabilities that were associated with that, you know, because it was exposed to the air. It was not necessarily pure. A lot of the vendors were foreign. And so there was this, you know, suspicion a lot of people had about, you know, whether they had the same, you know, hygienic standards. And so when Cracker Jack was put in a box and sold in grocery stores, this was just revolutionary. And of course, it could be trusted because it was pure. It could also be trusted because it would be fresh. You know, people were buying a lot of bulk food at the time out of barrels. And who knows how long it had been in there and what sort of it was exposed to. And when something was sealed in a package, it could be pretty much guaranteed as fresh. And that transformed, really, not just snack food, but I would say, you know, processed food.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you got a prize.
I was going to say, yeah, when did the prize come in?
I'm sorry, I don't know when exactly the prize came in, but I think quite early.
We're speaking with Abigail Carroll. She's an author and food historian, and her book is entitled Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take another break, and we'll be right back.
And we return with more food and dining on today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, along with author Abigail Carroll. Of course, we have chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. Linda, what's on your menu for this segment?
Well,
along with Abigail Carroll.
Well, it's really been, you know, it's been fascinating talking about the
Indeed.
History of eating and breakfast, lunch, and dinner and how that evolved. We always think, well, that's how everybody ate, but apparently not. And so I'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Does your family follow the three squares a day? And if not, what determines your eating habits? I mean, are you eating, grazing, not having your dinner? We'd love to know. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Bonnie, do we have email?
We do, radio@WLRN.org.
Well, also, I'd like to bring in our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker.
Indeed.
Yes, he's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, are we drinking?
We are always drinking. I thought I would talk a little bit about the history of wine, which is pretty interesting.
Of course.
Can you go back to colonial times?
I can go back 9,000 years.
All right, Fred. Well, Abigail Carroll, you've been describing how our three meals a day developed, the evolution of breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So why did you decide to write this book?
You know, I'd been doing some research for the Indiana State Museum on an exhibition that they were putting on, and I was researching the connection between snacking and obesity. And, you know, obesity is a relatively new phenomenon, and I thought to myself, well, is snacking a relatively new phenomenon? You know, what's the history of snacking? And I realized as I began to look into it that nobody had written a book on the history of snacking. So I set out to write a book on the history of snacking, and there was plenty of evidence, you know, plenty of material in the historical record. It was not hard to find. But then I realized very quickly that the history of the snack is really wrapped up in the history of the meal, because snacking and meals kind of overlapped for a long time, and the line between them was pretty blurry, and then it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution when they really became solidified as two separate entities, and I'd say they've had a pretty contentious relationship ever since. So I ended up writing a book that tells the story of both snacking and the meal.
You know, you say that snacks are replacing meals calorically, but for many, aren't they replacing meals altogether? I mean,
oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. So you know, the lunch. Oh, no, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so you know, snacking and grazing. You mentioned the earlier on that the American Indians were really grazing rather than eating at all. So we think grazing and snacking is our modern day event, but snacking has really become part of our culture.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we continue to carry a lot of reservations about it because the meal in the Victorian era came to mean so much more than food. It came to mean family and middle class status. And eventually it also became a way of identifying with the nation, especially in the early 20th century. And so to do something that went against the meal, that is to snack, was kind of an offense, not just to the meal, but to all that the meal represented. So in some ways it was about possibly spoiling your meal. But in some ways it was also, you know, about, you know, people were sometimes I know someone who told me once that when he grew up, his parents would say, "Don't snack. That's lower class. You don't want to be seen as lower class."
Mm. Or spoil your dinner.
For a while, aren't the French kind of down on snacking?
I really focused on the United States in the book.
Why is it such a heresy, say, to have spaghetti and meatballs for breakfast?
Or pizza.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it wasn't always that way. You know, like in the colonial era, breakfast was leftovers from dinner, very typically. And if not that, you know, maybe cornmeal mush with molasses or milk, that kind of thing, some bread and cheese, beer. But what happened in the 19th century is that people were eating very heavy meat-centric breakfasts that were basically like a miniature dinner. I wouldn't even say miniature. It was basically another dinner. And but they were starting to work in at desk jobs more, leading a more sedentary urban lifestyle. And they were getting indigestion. And the country basically had a national case of indigestion in the late 19th century.
I mean, because they were eating too much.
They were eating a farmer's diet, but mm-hmm. living an urban, modern, and more sedentary lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Well, Abigail, do you know when people started working in factories, how did they get their lunch? Did the factories provide it, or what happened?
Well, no, the factories did not provide meals. At first, a lot of people were living in boarding houses in the very early days of factories. You know, you think of a lot of the women in the mills. And so they would go back to the boarding house and they would be fed a lunch by the boarding house matron. And so that was really, really not lunch. That was still a continuation of dinner. But eventually people were working in factories and living farther away in the city itself. And so they couldn't just go back to a boarding house across the street. And they couldn't go home because they were too far from home. And so sometimes what would happen is their family or young children in the South, they were called dinner toters, would take a basket and carry a hot meal to them. And they would, you know, eat it there in the factory, often right where they worked. But it wasn't too long before people were bringing, you know, their lunch in a tin pail, and it was cold. And sandwiches really came in, okay. You know, into their own
well, we have,
during
we have
this time.
A few phone calls here, so let's take line two. Hello? Hi, Jack, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you?
Great.
I always enjoy your show, especially today. I grew up on a farm in California, and it was a dairy farm, and so we were always up early, and we would have a heavy breakfast, and then we would have dinner at noontime, and then we would have supper. And it was our custom that we had three fairly heavy meals throughout the day, and I just assumed that that was probably where the tradition of supper at lunch came in, and then dinner was in the evening. But it was all three heavy meals.
Interesting.
I have a question, Abigail. You said
thank you, Jeff.
You said that obesity was a recent phenomenon. I'm just wondering, this may not be something you researched, but how our caloric intake compares to other periods of our history.
Oh, that's a great question, and I'm sorry to say that I really didn't look at that specifically. Certainly, though, our caloric intake has been on the rise pretty consistently now for the past several decades, and snacking has really exploded, and I think that there's a correlation there with obesity.
Well, you know, with our fragmented lifestyle that we have today, eating in the car, you know, smartphones, texting, sports, band practice, two family members working. Is the family dinner really disappearing as headlines predict? And can the rise in obesity be connected with this unraveling of our meal patterns?
That's a great question. The family meal has been in decline since the 1950s, which is when it sort of, you know, was in its prime, but more so in the past few decades, especially with it becoming more typical for both parents to work, and so is home cooking. So it's, you know, that's on the decline, and what's on the rise is eating foods prepared away from home. And we spend about half of our food dollars on foods prepared away from home, whether they are, you know, at a restaurant or whether they are, you know, foods that we bring home and eat in the home or have delivered. But people talk to me about how they feel guilty about not eating meals. And I think that's because they see there is some real value in eating together. And studies actually underscore that. People do eat more healthily when they eat together, nutritionally speaking.
And they happen to talk to each other. That might be a healthy event as well.
Abigail, as a historian, do you think that time's ever going to come back where dinner will regain its former importance?
I think it could. I think we're really at a fork in the road, and I'm not sure which way we're going to go. I think that's something that as a society we would do well to be thinking about and to be intentional about. Where I'm skeptical is when I think about the incredible impact that business has on our lifestyles and our eating, our work, but also the processed and manufactured foods that have become so ubiquitous and so cheap and so affordable. And we have all of these cues to eat. We're surrounded by advertisements and, you know, cup holders in our cars. And we get on an airplane, we're served food. Or, you know, we go to a party, we're served food. We go to a movie and, you know, there's concessions. And there's always, always this sort of impetus to eat. And I think that it's, you know, we want to be thinking about, you know, what value does the meal have for individuals and for society? And it's not just nutrition. You know, studies show that when children grow up in families that are eating 4 to 6 times a week together in the evening, those children do better in school. On average, they get higher test scores, higher grades. They're also less likely to develop eating disorders. They're less likely to abuse alcohol. And little children, their word banks grow faster when they're, eating meals with their families regularly. So there's a lot of value there.
Right. Well, you know, on the one hand, we see more grazing and snacking and people not taking time. On the other hand, I personally have been seeing a trend, I don't know where it's going, of healthier eating, healthier foods in the markets. You know, foods are now being packaged with lower salt and lower fat and lower
sugar.
And
more locally grown.
And more locally grown. So perhaps that's a trend that we ought to talk about or at least encourage.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely a trend, and I think it's a good trend. But I think there's a question that begs to be asked, and that is the question of cooking. And can we be healthy if we're not cooking? Can we eat healthily if we're not cooking? And, you know, Michael Pollan's new book is really addressing this question. And I think that that's one of the questions behind the idea of reviving the home economics movement is, could there be a connection between obesity and cooking?
Right.
And, you know, there have been some studies that show, you know, correlations between a decline in cooking and a rise in obesity.
Well, on that note, we're going to take another short break. My guest is Abigail Carroll. She's been talking about the state of the American meal. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and I'm here with Bonnie Berman and Joseph Cooper and Fred Tasker, and we've been talking with Abigail Carroll, and she's been talking about the state of American meal. Her book is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. Well, I have an American meal for us right now. It's called Dinner in Minutes, and you can make this dinner at home and sit around the table and enjoy it. And this is an autumn burger slider with red pepper and sweet potatoes. Really quick dinner for the whole family. Mushrooms, onions, and a hint of maple syrup flavor this mini burger. And I've shortened your cooking time because a lot of it can be done in the microwave. So the onions and mushrooms are cooked in the microwave, and then I mixed some mustard and maple syrup together. So half those mushrooms and onions go inside the burger, inside the hamburger, and you make it that way. And then you saute the hamburgers, or you grill them, or however you like to cook your hamburgers. Place them on some mini burger rolls, and then the remaining onions and mushrooms go on top, and then I cover it with this delicious mustard and maple syrup coating. The sweet potatoes and red bell peppers, very easy. You peel the sweet potatoes, cut them in cubes, cut the red bell peppers in cubes, and microwave them. Toss them with a little olive oil and salt and pepper. Now, that whole meal can take you maybe 15, a joke takes you 20 minutes.
Probably.
Yes, to make. And the complete recipe and the photo is at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, we're drinking today. Should I ask?
Oh, yes, we are. In fact, I appreciate the great faith that you have in me. Linda has asked me to discuss the history of wine, which is 9,000 years worth of information in just a few minutes. So, sure, I can do that, I told her.
I told you could have one or two extra minutes.
I can have one more, more minute. That's great. Well, anyway, listen fast, because here we go. First, if you want to start a fist fight at a wine bar, try taking bets on who invented wine and when they did it. There's evidence that it was in China 9,000 years ago. Scholars have found pottery shards with residue of fermented rice and honey and grapes. Of course, in those days, wine didn't keep very well, so drinkers flavored it with everything they could, from ash to pine resin, which you see in the Greek wines, even lead, which made it taste sweeter, but of course tended to kill them.
Well, that's good.
Still, even children drank wine in those days because it was considered safer than that area's badly polluted water. And the same went for beer, for that matter. Wine came to the Americas in the 1500s when the conquistadores brought it to South America for sacramental purposes. By the late 1700s, Mexican missionaries had moved it up to California. Now, this was the mission grape, which was is still around, and it's kind of wimpy, flavorless stuff until you distill it into brandy. And then I gather it was pretty powerful. In California in the mid-1880s, about the time of the gold rush, settlers started bringing top-quality grapes from Europe, including today's Zinfandel, and started the industry that you'll recognize today. Early wineries were Buena Vista, Behringer, Montelena. They're all top wineries these days. Then came Prohibition from 1920 to 1933, and this created a great religious revival. Suddenly, sacramental wine, which remained legal, was in huge demand.
A lot of people going to church those days.
Yeah, and yeah. It actually saved a lot of the wineries from bankruptcy. Also, in those days, California grape growers would send to eastern U.S. cities big packages of grapes alongside packages of yeast, and they'd include a strong written warning not to get them too close together because they might turn into wine, and of course that would be illegal.
With instructions as well, huh? More instructions.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the 1960s and 70s, California started a boom in top-quality wines led by, everybody's heard of the late legendary Robert Mondavi. And today, U.S. West Coast wines regularly beat French wines in international blind tasting. So today, wine is cool, and Ivy League studies even say it's good for us in moderation. So Americans keep getting more and more savvy about wine every year, and it's become an everyday drink in a lot of households.
You still there?
If grazing is the new trend of eating, then the boom in wine bars and clubs ensures that sipping will go right along with it. In fact, in 2010, the U.S. became the world's biggest wine-drinking nation. So we can't get too proud because we lead the world in total consumption because there are so many of us. But on a per capita basis, the French still outsip us 6-1. So there you go, Linda, the history of wine in 3.7 minutes.
That was very good, Fred.
I didn't know you were timing it, Fred. That was very interesting. Bonnie, did you have a question?
I had a question for Abigail. I want you to talk about the advent of cereal and the Kellogg's and how that all came to pass and when it became like the breakfast food.
Sure. Well, you know, I talked about that national case of indigestion that Americans were suffering from in the mid to late 1800s because they were eating a farmer's breakfast, but sort of living a more sedentary, urban, modern lifestyle. And a lot of these people were going to sanitariums, basically kind of like a health spa, where they hoped to recover their health, and they would have water treatments, and they would eat a very simplistic diet. And one of the people running one of these was James Caleb Jackson. And, you know, he was serving people whole wheat in all sorts of different ways, and that was seen as a kind of panacea. And he was experimenting with new ways so that people wouldn't get bored eating the same, you know, whole wheat pudding over and over again. And he basically, you know, baked it and broke it up and then baked it again and came up with breakfast cereal. And it was so hard that people, you know, would soak it in milk for at least 10 minutes, but it was actually became traditional to soak it overnight. And John Harvey Kellogg was actually one of the people running the sanitarium. His was in Battle Creek, Michigan. And he, you know, built on this, as did other people who were interested in health. And they saw this as, you know, really a health food. But then once entrepreneurs saw the possibilities, it became sort of more commercialized. And one of those entrepreneurs was actually John Harvey Kellogg's brother, William Keith Kellogg. He was the first to add sugar to breakfast cereal, by the way.
One of them wound up in Miami in later life.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that, so he added sugar in that. And what was the first sugared cereal?
Well, I'm thinking of cornflakes. You know, they added sugar because...
That's right, frosted flakes.
They were looking, yeah, they were looking for a way to preserve it because the corn oil caused it to stale rather quickly, and they were experimenting with different, you know, solutions, and sugar ended up being not just a solution to that, but then becoming a kind of asset in that it made it more appealing.
Especially the kids.
So you went from something healthy to sugar pops and Count Chocula.
Exactly.
And tricks.
Yeah, well, it's been really, really interesting talking with you, Abigail Carroll. So to recap, the state of the American meal has always been evolving, and I guess it's just going to continue to evolve.
We'll have links to the book also on our Facebook page and the WLRN.org site.
And Abigail, do you have a specific website? Or
There is a website for the book at threesquaresbook.com, I think, something like that.
Okay.
Well, it's been a very, very interesting week. Abigail Carroll, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Her fascinating book is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. And next week, we'll be preparing for Thanksgiving. We're going to have Thanksgiving 101.
How many Thanksgiving programs have we done, Linda?
Well, I would say almost 15 since we've been doing it every year.
There's no such thing as too many Thanksgiving programs.
Well, we're going to have Thanksgiving 101 with Corey Vicens. She's from allrecipes.com. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents webpage. Facebook page. Today's slider recipe at dinnerminutes.com. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with the history of some 73,000 U.S. soldiers still listed as missing in action from World War II's Pacific Theater. And now an all-British calendar for November 14th. On this day in 1940, 73 years ago, the start of the devastating German bombing attack on the industrial city of Coventry. Some 500 bombers kill 380 and destroy a 14th century cathedral. Only one German bomber was shot down in the attack. And it's the 65th birthday of England's Prince Charles. He was born in 1948 at Buckingham Palace. His mother, Elizabeth, was crowned queen in 1953. One more before we shout tally-ho. On this day in 1973, 40 years ago, Charles's sister, Princess Anne, marries Captain Mark Phillips in Westminster Abbey. They divorce in 1992. So we leave with a thought from His Royal Highness, Charles, still heir to the throne, quote, "Do you seriously expect me to be the first Prince of Wales in history not to have a mistress?" Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.